This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, if you're tired of incivility and bad news, a new project that focuses on the positive. But first, from 1951 until 1989, the Feed Materials Production Center in Fernald, Ohio, not far from Cincinnati, was a key player in the Cold War, processing uranium for the United States nuclear weapons program. But in the 1980s, you couldn't watch or read the news without seeing a story about the environmental issues plaguing the site and causing concern and anger among its neighbors. When production at Fernald ended, cleanup and environmental remediation began. That work was finished in 2006, and today, the site is home to the Fernald Preserve, more than 1,000 acres of wetlands and wildlife habitat. On October 29th, the U.S. Department of Energy will host Weapons to Wetlands, A Decade of Difference. The event's going to mark the 10th anniversary of the Fernald remediation. And joining us with the story of Fernald and a preview of the anniversary event are Sue Smiley, Fernald Preserve Manager for the Department of Energy, Jeff Wagner with Fluor Fernald, a company that provides cleanup of radioactive waste for the Energy Department, and Lisa Crawford, a leader in the effort to close and clean up the plant. And you can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Lisa, Sue, and Jeff, thanks for being here this afternoon. Good to see everybody.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Lisa, what was Fernald like prior to being shut down? I mean, what kind of environmental problems and health issues was this causing for the community?
Well, we ended up with three off-site contaminated wells, and there had been huge dust releases, which, you know, when the dust comes out of the stacks, it blows everywhere. And I think that was the key in the beginning. 32 years ago, about this time of year, is when we learned about the dust releases. Then it was January of 85 when we learned about the off-site contaminated wells. And I just think it was anger and frustration in the community that, you know, nobody knew what they did there. Nobody had a clue. You know, it was years later that we found out about the releases and the contaminated water. And as mothers, which Fresh, my organization, was mostly women, aggressive women, we ask a lot of questions. And we were concerned about the health and safety of our children.
And this Fernald sits on top of the Great Miami Aquifer, so there was a lot of concern about what it was doing to the water supply in the area.
The aquifer was very, very contaminated. I mean, it still is to a certain degree, but much less so than it used to be.
Now, you could have just sat back and said, somebody else is going to step up and they're going to lead this. Why did you do it? How did you become involved?
I took it so personal because I lived in a rental house, and it's like, how dare you contaminate my well and not tell me for 5 years? And I think it was just that I had taken it so personal, and I had a small child, and I was concerned about my little boy's health and safety. And it just went all over me. I was just mad and angry and said, we just have to do this.
So what was the first thing that you did?
We went to a big public meeting. A DOE held a public meeting in January of 85. I took plastic bottles of water and cups with me that night. And they were like, these wells are contaminated, but it's not above the standards, and you can drink this water and blah, blah, blah. And I took my water and cups up there and sat them in front of the DOE people from Oak Ridge and said, then you drink it. And they wouldn't drink it. That's a very telling – that was the most telling – time for me. And I thought, well, by gosh, if you won't drink it, then why should we?
Yeah. And this is going back, what, 32
years? 32 years ago, about this time.
So, Jeff, we get to the point where Lisa, Fresh, they've all made an impact. They're saying we need to clean this place up, and that's what happens. The idea that that Fernald is now going to be remediated. Just how big of a job was this?
Oh, it was huge. It was literally seen as a job that could go on decades. Cost over $12 billion, which would make it the largest cleanup site in Ohio. And I think DOE realized right away that there was no need for enriched uranium back during the Reagan era, and decided they had to clean it up, and they had to be very open about it. And I think that's about the time when all this hit about the same, you know, confluence of factors came together, and then DOE approached it with, okay, we need to work with the public to find a solution. And that's when people like Lisa and Fresh.
Well, Fresh at that point just demanded a seat at the table. You know, we were like, oh, we're not going away. And the other fear I think we had was that they would lock the gate and walk, and we would end up with a national sacrifice zone. And we had met and made a vow that we would not let that happen.
And through Lisa's group later, helped because of their connections with Congress and the appropriators, was a big part why we got funded at a level we needed to. And instead of a 20-year cleanup, you know, a project that could have ended in 2019, we got done in 2006. And that's why we're looking forward to this Saturday marking the 10th anniversary and literally cut billions off the overall project. But you got to maintain facilities like that, even if you're not cleaning up. You have to maintain nuclear criticality safety. You have to maintain, you know, OSHA safety. So there's a lot of hotel costs that go into that. So the sooner, it's like a mortgage, the more you can pay up front, the more you can bring in the long-term costs and actually save some money.
It was an interesting time, I would add, that when we were starting to plan for the cleanup of the site, the CERCLA or Superfund law had just come out in 1980, and we were using that process to decide how to clean up the site. And that process requires that you engage the public in the decision-making process. It was also a time when a lot of the standards were just coming out, so there weren't necessarily standards to know, well, how much uranium in drinking water is safe. There were a couple of other industries near the Fernald site that were producing some of the same or using some of the same chemicals, maybe degreasers. And so you also have the issue of whose contamination is that? It's all going into the same aquifer. So through that, the Superfund process and engaging the public in the decision-making process, it took literally 10 years to figure out the extent of contamination, plan how we were going to tackle it, and execute the actual cleanup to the point where we could say, we're done with this aspect of it. It's time to turn it over to another departmental element to do the sort of the long-term stewardship of the site.
Well, is this the first time that a cleanup of this extent had ever taken place?
Well, there's another big project in Colorado, Rocky Flats, and they were on a similar timeline as we were. But again, they've kind of had different standards, too, standards that were determined by their public, just like we had our own standards.
Not near as good as ours.
The Mound plant in Miamisburg was on the exact same timeline, really, as Fernald in terms of when we started to figure out it needs to be cleaned up.
And because, if I remember the news right, it was becoming an issue in the early 80s. I was seeing a lot of news stories about Mound back then.
Yeah, and then in 1989, I think, is when the Department of Energy decided to close several plants because the Cold War was over. We didn't need to be producing elements that would go into the manufacture of nuclear weapons.
Well, and I think it's important, too, that each community, you know, Rocky Flats, their community made that decision about their cleanup. I would have never have agreed to that, but that's me. Mound, you know, they decided they were going to do, help me, Sue.
It's clean to an industrial use standard
and business, more of a business aspect. And out where we live, we just didn't want that. We wanted more of a green space. You know, we had enough of the nasty, dirty industry. So we were really looking forward to bringing it back to its natural state and kind of just making it a community asset.
Lisa, did you ever think that you would be doing something like this in your life?
No, never.
Did you become an environmental activist like you?
No, never. But, you know, sometimes things are just thrown at you and you pick up the reins and you go and you do what you think you need to do.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And let's talk with Joey. Hi, Joey.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
My father actually worked with a lot of you on the site and cleanup, and I just remember him talking about it and actually living in Rust and going to the site and going on a field trip to actually see it after it was all cleaned up. His name was Pete.
Very good.
Yeah.
It's a community asset now. We get about 12,000 visitors a year that come to the site to hike the trails, see the visitor center, which shows the entire history from when the property was purchased via eminent domain all the way to when the cleanup was done. A lot of school kids, a lot of outreach to Rotary Club meetings, things of that nature.
Boy Scouts.
A lot of Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts.
How much were people in the community involved in getting the cleanup done, Jeff?
Oh, I'd say very much. You had groups like the Fernald Citizens Advisory Board, which Lisa was a part of, and you literally had members kind of a cross-section from around the entire area. Academia, just general workers, elected officials, folks like Lisa that had been involved, and they all sat down. They tried to work through and understand there were a lot of difficult issues. As you can imagine, a site that was this big, it had this many, you know, it had silos, it had waste pits, it had 10 huge industrial buildings that needed to come down, aquifer contamination, everything else. So you kind of needed to understand the extent of the contamination, different approaches to clean it up, set standards, and really understand the tough issues and determine, hey, you know, as far as you got all this building debris and all, it's low levels of contamination, but still, do you want to ship it 2,000 miles to Nevada? Or do we weigh that with the environmental risks and health risks associated with building an on-site disposal facility? So it's those tough issues that the public really had to wrap their arms around, and they had to make some tough choices.
So what did happen with the waste?
The highest level of contamination, the radium-bearing waste that were in the two concrete silos, the waste pit waste, where you had a million tons of different blends
whatever
excess material that was dumped out there. All those, the inventory of product, that all got shipped off-site. But the building debris, the contaminated soils, the lower risk items but high volume are now safely buried in an on-site disposal site.
So you're using a combination of both techniques to address it.
Exactly, on and off-site waste.
And the community and the workers and all of us played a role as we sat at the table of, we will not be NIMBYs. We will not pull that not in my backyard stuff. And I had been to Nevada. I had been to some of the other places where the waste was going. We had toured the sites. And we just wanted to make sure what we sent offsite was sent safely and the community receiving it knew about it. We were really adamant about that. And I think it clearly showed a good faith effort for us to say, we're going to keep 85% of our waste here at Fernald. This is our legacy. This is going to be government-owned land forever, and we will have an on-site disposal facility, and I will not dump everything in somebody else's backyard. That was a little bit of a controversial issue at the time, but we all came together and made that tough, hard decision.
Now, is the cleanup being used as a model for other cleanups across the nation?
Absolutely. Most recent example I can think of, and Jeff, you can chime in, is the Portsmouth facility, which is a DOE-owned facility in Piketon, Ohio. They're grappling with the very same issues that we had grappled with years ago and are, in fact, going to be building an on-site disposal facility. So folks from Portsmouth have come over and actually looked at our design documents, our performance data on how well the landfill is functioning at Fernald, and they're taking those lessons learned back to the Portsmouth facility.
When we finished at Fernald Fresh, my organization gave them a huge challenge, gave DOE a huge challenge. We were able to save a ton of money and do it in 10 years, and we learned a lot of lessons along the way. And we challenged them to take that forward and use it somewhere else, at Portsmouth or wherever. And I've seen that at Ports. I've not seen it anywhere else, but I don't pay a lot of attention out west anymore. But, you know, it's like when you spend this much money and you learn these lessons, we really want to make sure that they don't get lost in the shuffle.
And we're fortunate to be just 100 miles away, so we can come right here, we can meet with the people that were keys to it, and learn the lessons when it comes to public outreach and public involvement on decision making. And again, that's a site, they want jobs. That's an area where they don't want an undeveloped park. They want to see some kind of industrial park follow. So they definitely,
and that's the community's choice.
Yeah.
We will continue our conversation about Fernald, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us with the story of Fernald and a preview of an upcoming event at the Fernald Preserve, our preserve manager, Sue Smiley, Jeff Wagner with Fleur Fernald, and Lisa Crawford, a leader in the effort to close and clean up the plant. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Sue, describe the Fernald Preserve. I mean, we hear this awful place. It was bleak. It was contaminated. And it's so much different today.
It is now called the Fernald Preserve. It's a it's an undeveloped park. We have over 7 miles of hiking trails, and they go through all different kinds of there's wetlands, prairies, forest. We have a very nice visitor center that was actually built in a facility that when we were done with the cleanup, we were able to leave it behind and repurpose that facility and make it into a really nice visitor center that has the history of how the plant, how the land was first acquired, what happened during the production era, how the cleanup was done. And that's we get about 12,000 visitors a year just to that facility. It's interesting if you look at a aerial photo of today and compare it to an aerial photo of, say, during the production era, it's now a bunch of green space, forests, and some wetland areas. And a lot of the wetlands are actually built over the holes, the excavations that remained after we tore down the contaminated buildings. And it's a natural clay soil, so it holds water great. It's provided a great ecosystem.
I want to add, 32 years later, when I drive in the front gate of the Fernald Preserve now, when you get so far back, you have to make a really hard left turn. And that's where the old guard gates were before production ceased and all this went on. And I always stop there because it's my aha moment or my wow moment or whatever you want to call it, because I look, I sit in my car and I always look and think, wow, how amazing is this? Because it's all the dirt and the contamination and the nasty buildings and all of that is now gone. And we have this beautiful, you know, green space that is just amazing. And I always ask people, when you drive in, always stop there. People who have been involved in this for 32 years, like me, because it does something to you. It's just like, wow.
Lisa, are you and the other folks who've been involved in this, are you still keeping an eye on what's going on with Fernald?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We made a pact that when we got done 10 years ago, that we wouldn't just go away. And we could have. We could have folded our tent and went home. But we decided, you know, this was our legacy. This is what we asked for. And we still pay attention. We pay attention. You know, I'm at the site probably at least maybe once a week, once every few weeks, you know. We get asked to come and speak to people. You know, if the crew over there asks me to come, I come. So it's important for us to stay involved.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And let's talk with Mike in Columbia, Tusculum. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, I've been out there and toured more than once. The museum is, I would call, state-of-the-art, very impressive. And the grounds are just absolutely beautiful, especially at this time of year. I'd recommend it to anyone. I remembered it as a kid who was always like, what is that back there? No one quite knew for sure. But my question is there an effort to link it up with a continuous green space all the way to, was it Miami Whitewater Forest, the great Emerald County Park out there? That'd be a wonderful, unbroken piece of green land. Thank you.
This is Sue. I have heard that that's something that's being contemplated, but there's no guarantee that will actually happen because it takes people who are willing to maybe sell their properties or sell a conservation easement. So at this stage, we're concentrating on using settlement funds from a state claim against under the natural resources damages to restore areas on the Fernald site and areas that are for the most part contiguous to the, did I say mound? To the Fernald site.
I think you said Fernald.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
good.
Right. Yeah.
That's okay.
And what we do is those funds are used to either purchase land outright or just purchase a conservation easement so that we can have that, at least that, contiguous with the site.
How much wildlife is in the preserve?
A bunch.
A lot more than there used to be.
Take time to count up what's out there?
We do with the birds, or at least we have counted the number of different species of birds. The bird watchers love to come to our site. They've come from all over the United States to see some of the birds. We had the first recorded bobcat in, is that Butler County? Yeah,
probably.
Butler County. So it's a really big deal.
see a lot of deer, see a lot of things we used to not see.
Mink,
so that
beaver.
Tells us the land is rehealing itself, and it's kind of reinvigorating itself and coming back. And, you know, when you drive the winding road back to the visitor center, I mean, you see deer, you see swans, you see birds, you see all kinds of stuff. And that is, that's, I like that. That makes me feel better.
Well, and one of the things that's really neat is they went back and looked at old survey maps and data from the 1800s on what this area of the state looked like in terms of species of plants. And those were the kinds of things that we tried to reintroduce. So there's prairies that we have planted there because that's what used to be there. And if there's things that come in that we don't want, such as honeysuckle, we remove those, and then that allows the natural vegetation to flourish.
We had an email from Yvonne who said she was at the preserve shortly after it opened, and she saw signs that said no dogs allowed and not to pick up any objects. So she's still wondering if that's the case.
It is. Because it's a preserve, it's a wildlife preserve, dogs are not allowed because they would disturb the wildlife. You're also not allowed to, for instance, go mountain biking. Oh, and the thing on, we do have a procedure that if you were walking along and you saw something that looks like a piece of metal sticking out of the ground or something, you shouldn't touch it. You should report it to the Department of Energy. We would go out and take a look at it, make sure that it doesn't have any kind of fixed radioactive contamination, and when we
so
find,
it might be part of the old site.
It might be a piece of construction rubble, like a piece of concrete. So we pick up those pieces and we store them on site, and there's a very small number. I mean, in the past 10 years, I don't know what the number is, but it's really low, and we will ship it away as waste.
But there's still pumping and treating going on. Actually, the aquifer, even though the contamination, I think it was originally 225 acres, that has shrunk dramatically, but that's a long process. I mean, it's literally pumping hundreds of thousands of gallons each day that enabled you to get that uranium and pull that out of the aquifer and clean it up. So that's something that's still and will be monitored for quite a long time. But the bulk of the cleanup is what we're going to mark got finished up 10 years ago. So just an amazing effort by and really so many different chapters, so many different elements of it really make it a pretty neat story.
Let's talk to Grace in Delhi. Hi, Grace.
Hi. My question is, my brother died of bladder cancer. He lived in Harrison, Ohio in the 80s, and they said it was environmentally caused. Have you had any documentation on the incidences of cancer because of the Fernald plant?
There's a group, and I'm going to turn to Lisa, too, so correct me if I'm wrong. There's a group called the Fernald Community Cohort, and the University of Cincinnati, which is, of course, independent from the Department of Energy. They've been doing health studies, went back and looked at the health of people in the community as well as workers, and they continue to keep track of that data. And they come to the site every once in a while and chat with folks who may have questions regarding family illnesses. And
well, and I think, Sue, that's good. A good point is on Saturday, a couple representatives from the Fernald Community Cohort will be at the site with a table. And I sit on their advisory board. And through the years, what we've seen is a higher incidence of breast cancer, colon cancer, and kidney cancer. This is within the 5-mile radius from the center of the Fernald site, 5 miles out. So I don't know in Harrison where the man might have lived, but, you know, their focus is that 5-mile radius. Mm-hmm. But those are the three that we've noticed.
But the cohort's going to be at the
yes.
event on Saturday.
Yes,
so.
Dr. Susan Penny will be there with the data and the information.
And Jeff, tell us a little bit more about the event that's coming up.
Well, it's this coming Saturday. It starts at 10 o'clock, 10 to 2. It's more of an open house. There is going to be a program at 11 o'clock where we've got some speakers from the department, key stakeholders like Lisa, Ohio EPA, which was a key part of the cleanup, will be out there. And they're going to have shuttle tours so they can take you around the 1,050-acre preserve. I think the disposal cell, you have an opportunity if you want to hike
yes.
up to the top of it. It's a fantastic view of the cleaned-up site from up there. But it's meant to more introduce people, if they haven't been out to Fernald in 10 or more years, to come on out.
Lisa, what do you think is the lesson from Fernald?
Hopefully the government learned a huge lesson. I really hope they did. That, you know, I know in the 50s, I know years ago, all this stuff was built and done. But the whole key now, the lesson I want them to learn is, if you engage your community, if you keep them educated and you keep them involved, better decisions will be made and there will be less consequences.
Well, Lisa, Sue, and Jeff, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
Sue Smiley, Fernald Preserve Manager for the Department of Energy, Jeff Wagner with Fleur Fernald, and Lisa Crawford. Weapons to Wetlands, A Decade of Difference is going to be held at the Fernald Preserve. Again, that's on October 29th. And you can find a link to more information about the event at WVXU.org. Up next, we're going to hear how sharing our stories can bring understanding and kindness to our lives. And in Focus on Technology, an iPod playlist is helping dementia patients reconnect with loved ones. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.